No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will try to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Tonight, we have an extra special guest, Dr. Larry J. Sabato, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who is a political oracle. The man is unbelievable in his ability to predict elections. He is a best-selling author. He's won 4 Emmy Awards. He's recognized as one of the nation's most respected political analysts. He appears multiple times a week on national and international TV. He's the founder of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, and I'm so excited to have him. Dr. Larry Sabato, thanks so much for being on my show.
I'm delighted to be with you, and I'm so pleased to hear you're working on all those issues.
Well, let me tell you something. Now, you're not going to remember this, Doc, but 42 years ago, you walked into my office. You walked into the Democratic National Committee and asked to talk to somebody about direct mail, and I was, at the time, the director of all in-house direct mail programs at the Democratic Committee, and you interviewed me briefly, and I think you even interviewed my boss. And the reason I'm telling you this is because ever since that day, ever since the day I met you, I have followed your career, and I've just been amazed at some of the things you've been able to do and some of the things you've been able to predict, and the whole crystal ball thing, which I hope we can talk about in a minute, and your ability to predict elections. So I'm so happy to have you here. And let me ask you as my first question, since you've been doing this for more than 40 years, what have you seen? What is the major change you've seen in the electorate over that period of time? Has the electorate changed in 40 years?
First, let me say, I do remember that visit to the DNC. I was working on a book that was published as The Rise of Political Consultants, which became a bestseller, and got my career off to a good start. I just celebrated my 54th anniversary here at UVA. It's hard to believe. I'm in my 70s now, but and you're just
you and
a young
me both.
You're 35, 40, something like that. I can tell from your young voice. Anyway, let me answer your question instead, so we don't waste time praising each other. But look, I would say it's not so much the electorate has changed as it is the media environment has changed. That is, social media has transformed the way we look, the public looks at politics, and not necessarily in a good way. Yes, there are many fine people on it. They do their best to get correct information out there to people. Unfortunately, there are a lot of very sketchy characters who have poisoned our minds with inaccurate and misleading and dangerous information, not just about politics, but about, say, the vaccines, all the wonders that science has produced for us. And without good information, without accurate information, people cannot make good judgments when they go to the polls. So if you force me to cite one thing, I'd cite that, as well as, of course, the proliferation of news outlets that also don't tell the truth.
Well, is there anything we can do about this? Because, you know, what I've always thought, Dr. Sabato, is that people really don't go out in search of the truth. They go out in search of information that supports their prejudices. You know what I mean? That, and it seemed to me that on the internet, I don't care what your crazy idea is, you're going to find somebody on the internet that agrees with you and that reinforces your belief, right? No matter what you say, I've heard the most ridiculous things put out there, and there are people that believe them and say things to me. I had a checker in the grocery store say to me the other day, well, you know, Senator, Joe Biden just screwed everything up. And I'm like, well, what is he screwed up? She couldn't give me one example of anything he screwed up. But yet, you know, there's that sense. So is there anything we can do to combat this?
Well, I chuckled when you were saying that because you reminded me of something a few years back that Bob Schieffer, who once was moderator of CBS's Face the Nation.
Yeah, I know.
I was talking to him about what had changed in politics, and he said, you know, the internet has made it so easy for all the crazy people to go online and find other people just as crazy as they are.
Yeah.
And really, that has produced the revival of some of these horrible organizations, like I think of the Proud Boys and the neo-Nazis that marched right in front of my home here in Charlottesville, Virginia. It makes it so easy for them to connect and to follow through on their nefarious plans. And is there anything we can do about it? I don't think, short of shutting down the internet or social media or having very strict regulations on it, which will never pass or be upheld by the courts, and particularly this Supreme Court, this particular Supreme Court.
Yeah,
I think we're stuck with it all. I really do.
That's horrible. It's a horrible thing to think about, but yeah, I think unfortunately you're right. And you know what? I think that unfortunately it's going to get worse because I have adult children, and my children don't watch CNN. They don't watch MSNBC. They don't watch, you know, they don't watch Hannity either, thank God. But they do get most of their information from the internet. And I'm not even sure they watch TV shows anymore. I think they watch most of the entertainment they get is off their computers. So it looks like we're gonna have a hard battle before us. So, but let me ask you about something that I've realized as a Democrat. Okay, I've been a liberal Democrat for ever since I began my career. In fact, I think I was born a Democrat. Because I was poor. I was orphaned at the age of 15. I had to work my way. I got my first full-time job when I was 14, became a Teamster at 17 because I lied about my age. So I was a truck driver. Yeah. Oh yeah. The best part of that, Doc, is that for my first Christmas bonus, they included a bottle of scotch and a carton of Camel cigarettes when I was 17 years old, and they gave me the scotch before they put me in the truck in the morning, which was the absolute best part. I often say to the local labor guy, hey, what would your lawyer say of that today? But anyway, how did the Democrats lose these people? Do you have any idea? How did a billionaire convince working people that he feels their pain? I just can't wrap my head around that.
Well, of course, Trump has a certain way about him, a way of communicating that people who perhaps have not had the benefit of higher education or who have not read widely about politics, and a lot of people can't because they have to work all day and work six days a week or whatever. But he has a way with them, and he was transformed by that, what I consider to be that awful TV show, The Apprentice. But lots of people liked it. They watched it. A lot of my students watched it.
Yeah.
And I found it revolting. I watched it one time just to see what they were talking about. And I found him as offensive as I later found him to be in politics. But people are fooled by television. They think what they see on television, not just the internet, must be true. Many of my students have said to me at one time or another, well, I read that in print. I know it's true. I said, where did you read it? And they'll cite some ridiculous internet site that's been proven over and over to be inaccurate. Or they'll say, I saw it on the evening news. Well, what evening news show? And they're watching Fox, or they're watching some of these the Newsmax or OAN. Being discriminating about the sorts of sources that they rely on. You must do that, whether you're writing a paper for class, a term paper. If you're citing sources that are wildly inaccurate, I can guarantee you, you're going to be lucky to get a C. You'll probably get a D or an F. Well, the same thing is true in life, except we don't grade people's votes. They have to live with them. They have to live with them. And after 4 years of Trump, people figured out that he wasn't the right person for the job. Here he is. He might come back, but I doubt it. I'm still holding on to the belief that people will see through a lot of this in the 6 months we have to go before people start voting.
Well, yeah. First of all, I think we've got 6 months of him continuing to say ridiculous things, which certainly can't be helpful for them. I don't know why Republicans, for example, wanted to bring women back into the fold. So they decided to put a senator in a kitchen because that's where women want to go back to, right? And then after that horrible presentation, the other senator from Alabama refers to her as a housewife. And this is supposed to impress women. Oh, let's not hold her accountable. She was just a housewife. Oh my God, you know. But that's something I've got to say is that when I started in politics, I've been in politics for 40 years. This man has violated every rule that we were taught. You know, I helped train candidates that want to run for political office through a group in California, and we teach them don't annoy women because women are the majority of the electorate. Don't attack the press because, you know, you need them to be on your side. This man has done everything that we tell our candidates not to do and he gets elected. I mean, that I don't get either. Have you think politicians have changed in their approach?
Well, I think some politicians have figured out a way to make their obnoxiousness appealing. Trump is by no means the only example. You have so many,
that's true.
No better than I do, in the Senate, in the House of Representatives, in other elective offices, and they feed off the negative publicity they get. And somehow this convinces a lot of their constituents that they must be doing a good job because the people that they dislike in the media or in other organizations are opposed to this particular politician, and so they'll run and vote for him again. He represents their anger. He represents their anti-establishment feelings. He becomes a kind of reverse populist. By no means is Donald Trump a populist. How can anyone worth as much as he is, and he may not be a billionaire, but he's worth a lot, how could somebody who's worth what he's worth and who's done the things that he's done represent people who can barely keep it together, barely put food on the table, you know, don't have two extra nickels to rub together? And it's a pretty effective job that he does and that he has done now for, well, 9 years, counting the campaign of 2016.
Well, and you know, I don't know how we went from campaign slogans like "Ask not what your country can do for you" to "I am your retribution." "I am your retribution" isn't a campaign slogan; it's a threat. You know, I don't know how we got there. But let me ask you something that I found very, very interesting that Bill Maher said this week on his show. He talked about Canada and how and other Northern European countries, small Northern European countries, and how they've moved far to the left. And he's talked about, for example, in Canada, unemployment's higher than the United States, the air pollution's worse, they have a housing problem, debt, health care. They spend 13% of their their gross national product on health care, and they don't have a good health care system. And he said it's his opinion when you go too far to the left, you push the people in the center to the right, and that's how you end up with people like Trump. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, there might be if we'd done it, but we haven't done that. And I have to defend Canada here. Canada's a lovely place.
Yeah, it is a lovely place, and he even says that.
Yeah, I mean, you find that life is very agreeable there, and the people certainly are. So I completely disagree with his premise. But look, if you go too far to the right, you push people to the left. If you go too far to the left, you push people to the right. I can buy that to a certain degree because people don't like extremes, and America is basically centrist. We may be center-left in some eras, like the Reagan era. We may be center-right, but we are firmly in the center, in the mainstream. At least we have been. I don't think we were that way during the Trump years. I think we were in crazy. I don't know whether we were in the right or in the left, but we were crazy. There were so many weird things going on, and he had so many weird assistants doing strange, dangerous things. And it will be even worse in his second term if he gets back in.
Well, the lovely thing about Republicans, Doctor, is that they seem to be able to rat each other out pretty effectively. When the ship goes down, they all seem to bail. So we're seeing more and more of those people that you're talking about coming out, talking about the malfeasance that was involved in the administration. And I personally believe, and I don't know if you agree with this, but I think since he couldn't win in 2020, he's in a worse position now, and I don't think he'll be able to win in 2024. Do you think, especially with what they're doing to women? You know, when we were here in Washington, when Biden was giving awards to the Rosie Riveters, giving them the Congressional Medal of Honor, the Republicans in Arizona were taking women back to the 19th century. So I think that that's really going to haunt them in this election. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I certainly agree that reproductive freedom is perhaps the best issue, individual issue, that Democrats have. Now, they have many parts of Biden's record to brag about, and they have to do a better job of that. I must say the communicating of his record has been subpar for several years. But on the specific of the overturning of Roe v. Wade, and the fact that Republicans in so many places have gone way beyond that. In Alabama, opposing
impeachment.
Are you serious? There are also Republicans talking about reining in that dangerous contraception. I just don't know what has gotten into them. And I think more of their mainstream members, and they do still have mainstream members. They were the ones who voted for Nikki Haley. Right. There are plenty of them. Maybe it's a quarter of the party or 30%, whatever you want to say. They are starting to realize how extreme many of these Republicans are. And abortion's just one example, but it's something that really grabs not just women, but a lot of men, because we realize that politicians are the last people who ought to be dictating to us our personal mores and how we live our lives. And for women, how they control their bodies. This is just, it's insane, really. It's absolutely insane. We're going way backwards. For a long time, I kidded they were taking us back to the 1950s, and I was wrong. They're taking us back to the 1850s.
Right. I mean, it's crazy. And let me just give you another example that might hit a little closer to home for you, since home is Charlotte, Virginia. Recently, the Virginia pilot, I want to shift gears a little bit here, published an article that Governor Youngkin has requested the syllabus from George Mason University and VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, on their diversity curriculum. Is this an attack on academic freedom? Certainly the professors at George Mason and VCU have expressed that opinion, that they think it's an attack on academic freedom. Do you think that's the case, and do you think we're going to see more of this?
Well, we're obviously going to see more of it. It's funny you bring that up, because I just had former governor Doug Wilder, who's a good friend,
He's
here.
A good man, too.
Yeah. Usual talking to students. He's brilliant in the classroom. And by the way, he's 93.
I know. We had him on our show last year. I know. And still,
he gives hope. He gives me hope. He starts off every speech by saying, "I'm so pleased to be here." Actually, at 93, I'm pleased to be anywhere.
Yeah.
But he is as sharp as a tack. And he's furious about the fact that Youngkin has requested these syllabi. It's obviously an attempt to chill not just academic freedom generally, but specific professors. It's so obvious what he's doing. He's trying to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion. DEI, he's doing everything he can, just as Governor Ron DeSantis has been doing down in Florida. Why? Because it appeals to the far right of the Republican Party, and they're the ones who control the nominating process. And both DeSantis and Youngkin want to run for president in 2028. DeSantis has already done it and failed miserably. He wants to try again. Youngkin almost ran this time and decided he would be better off running in 2028. We'll see whether that's true. But this is very disturbing. Look, you know, I've been teaching since the mid-1970s. No one has ever told me what I could put in or had to keep out of a syllabus. That's my business. And by the way, it's the students' business as to whether they're attracted enough to the class to take it.
Right.
That's their decision, not a politician's decision. It's my decision what I think is relevant to the class, because I've studied the issue for decades. It is not a politician's decision, because I can guarantee you they know less about these specific subjects than I do. I've spent my career on them. So we're getting to the point where ideology is determining far too much. And it has infected the Republican side of the aisle to a disturbing degree.
Well, I hope that's the case. And Nikki Haley actually won the primary in Washington, D.C. So, you know, we certainly do know that there are some Republicans that haven't had the Kool-Aid to drink at this point. But let me ask you to keep your professorial hat on for a second. And, you know, earlier you said that we tend to be, middle of the road as a nation. And that's really how democracy is supposed to work, right? The aberrations are supposed to cancel each other out and push us towards the middle. But you and I have a master's degree in political science, and I studied Karl Marx, among other political philosophers, and I know you're very familiar with him. And I think he would say that this was an inevitability, the gridlock that we have in our politics now is inevitable, because when everybody follows their own self-interest, there's no way to promote the common interest. Do you think there's any truth to that? Do you think that we're getting to a point where we're just going to line up against each other and not be able to get anything done? Because we were always taught that our system was going to evolve to be a little more socialist than it was. It was going to be more like the Northern European countries are. Do you think that's true? Have we gone in that direction?
Well, to some degree. For example, we care enough about health care now to provide right. at least some basic health care to people who can't afford insurance. Now, if you want to say that's like Sweden, well, of course it isn't like Sweden.
Right.
Any of the other countries and Canada go much, much further than we do. But I call it not socialism. I call it progress. that's right. The way I look at it. We're trying to help people's basic needs and meet people's basic needs. But you know, I don't think that is the central problem. Our problem stems from the fact that our institutions were created in a completely different time. In the 1780s and 1790s, they were changed over time, but not very much. We still have the Electoral College, which makes no
right.
sense when you really sit down and think about it. If it made sense, then I think some of the other countries around the world might well have an electoral college. They don't. They rely on the popular vote. At least the democracies do. So we have all of these institutions, the Senate, which you know well,
two senators
per state. So California, with 10% of our population, has two senators, and Wyoming, with a fraction of 1% of our population, has two senators. Does that make any sense? No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. And we have not had the opportunity to change the fundamentals, and I don't see any hope of us having that opportunity. Until we do, we're going to have fundamental organizational problems with the way our country deals with problems.
Well, yeah, and how do you think we accomplish that? Does that take some sort of revolution? You know, I'm a child of the 1960s, Doc, the same as you are, I think. And, you know, we were going to change the world, and we were calling for revolution, which never really happened. We kind of evolved into working, you know, the work world. But is that what it's going to take? Is it going to take a revolution to change those institutions?
Well, I hope not. You can certainly see, if you look around the world, where most stable countries at one time or another have had something approaching revolution. I think we all got a great lesson about that on January 6th, 2021. We never want to go that far for either side. And, of course, Democrats haven't. Only Republicans have done that. Only Donald Trump supporters have done that. But that is not the way change should happen. In a small D democratic society, change should happen maybe gradually, maybe in some cases in an accelerated fashion, as it did in the 1960s. After the Kennedy assassination, you have to give Lyndon Johnson a lot of credit, despite the Vietnam War, which I strongly opposed at the time. But he got a lot done, partly because of the assassination of President Kennedy, and then the same thing happened after Dr. King was assassinated, finally got an open housing law, finally got some gun control, and the assassination of Bobby Kennedy contributed to that as well. It's sad to think that it takes things like that to push the country toward common sense reforms, but unfortunately, that's human nature, whether you're in a democratic society or an authoritarian society or something in between.
Well, you know, the one difference that I see is that I, too, protested the Vietnam War, and I went down on the Mall and protested against it. I was against it, but I also signed up for the draft when I was 18. I don't know if do we still have that spirit? You know, I didn't want to go. I didn't want to see my friends go, but I said, if I have to go, then I have to go. You know, it's my obligation. Do you think you're in touch with young people? The only young people I'm in touch with are my two daughters, who are always telling me I'm wrong. But, you know, I made the mistake of letting their mom get them on their side, on her side. But you're in touch with young people all the time. Is there still a sense that we had a sense of being an American? Is there still that sense out there that there's something noble about being an American?
I believe so. I really do. You know, I have a different perspective because I do teach, and I've had 26,000 students over the years. And I teach a big class on the Kennedy presidency, for example. That's not the only one I cover, but in this class, it is, because there's so many pieces to it. And, you know, when you teach one lecture about a presidency, you're not going to cover very much. So we do this whole semester on Kennedy. And I have to tell you, what has really encouraged me and made me optimistic in my old age is that students really get inspired by the same words that inspired us. You know, I cover all of the key Kennedy speeches. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country, as you mentioned earlier. There are students who are really inspired by that. They've never heard it before. They didn't know it existed. They hadn't listened to Kennedy's inaugural address. And I get it. They were born in the 21st century. But they get inspired by that. They get inspired by Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. They get inspired by some of the things Bobby Kennedy said. I'm just picking them out because I mentioned them earlier. You can get inspired by what Lyndon Johnson did. He wasn't the greatest speech maker, but he certainly inspired people in terms of the things that he did. And there were many other presidents like that too. In both parties, we had presidents in both parties who accomplished a lot and moved us forward. And I find that students still respond to that. They don't want to be uninspired. They don't want to have their ideals crushed. They want to believe that the future can be better than the present and the past. And it can be. That's what I teach. I think they believe it. And believe me, if they didn't believe it, they'd tell me. My students are just like your daughters.
Yeah. That's a problem with young people, isn't it? They tell you exactly what they think.
Strength. They question, you know, the old bumper sticker we used to have in our cars, question authority. It's the same thing. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with it. And that's the way it should be. And that's why I support, you know, people like AOC in Congress. I think that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I don't agree with her half the time, but I think she's an important voice. I think young people have to have a voice. I think old people have too much of a voice in our Congress. But we have to have all sorts of voices. I think that's the only way to harmonize as an electorate. Let me ask you, because the people will kill me if I don't ask you these questions. Let me ask you about your new book, Red Ripple. What do the 2022 elections have to teach us about 2024?
You know, it's a very good question, because 2022 broke the mold for midterms. Because the old rule used to be, and it lasted for decades, that wanted to know what was going to happen, you just looked at the incumbent president's approval rating and the state of the economy, and then you knew whether the president's party was going to be demolished or just lose seats but not demolished. And almost never did the president's party gain seats in a midterm election. Well, guess what happened? As you know, again, better than I do, Democrats ended up taking the House of Representatives. They lost it by a few votes, but they were on track to lose maybe 35 seats. Right. They ended up losing a handful, and we already see what's happened. We practically got a tie in the House. And then look at the Senate. Everybody on both sides privately said, Democrats don't have a chance to hold this Senate. They're going to lose three or four seats, and, you know, here and there. Well, actually, Democrats gained a seat. They got a majority, 51 seats total out of it. They gained a governorship. So what it taught me, again, was, because I've seen it before, when you're as old as we are, you see almost everything before. But it reminded me that just because something is a rule that has governed the past does not mean that it's an iron rule of politics that will apply every time. And it didn't apply. Democrats did better. Why? The overturning of Roe v. Wade, the overdominance of Donald Trump in the public sphere, and people were getting sick of him again, and they were reminded as to why they got rid of Trump and put Biden in. And lo and behold, we were surprised on election night. So 2024 isn't going to be as cut and dried as people living in April of 2024 think it's going to be. You know, you talk to everybody about politics. So do I. Nobody ever asks me about the weather or sports or They just ask about politics. And they all tell me, I mean, almost to a person, except for very, you know, partisan people who I love, they all tell me, well, you know, Trump's getting back in. This thing, it's over. There's no way Biden's going to win. People just hate him. And they think the economy's terrible, and they think blah, 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 on and on and on. You know what? I'll bet they're wrong. And we don't see it now, and we may not see it even at the end, but we might see it on election night.
Well, I hope you're right, because you know what? One thing I've learned in politics is I'm you know, I get Social Security right now, and I'm glad that my 401k is making a lot of money, because the stock market's doing great, but people see the economy as the cost of a loaf of bread and the cost of a tank of gas, don't they? I mean, that for the average person, That's what the economy is. So can Democrats really push that we have a good economy, even though we see unemployment coming down? We see, wages going up. We see inflation stabilizing. Do people care about that until we can get the price of gas and the price of bread down?
Well, Democrats have to make that case. You're saying, are they able to do it? Should they do it? The answer is yes, yes.
Yeah.
Because people are going to hold to those biases, and there are biases, unless they're confronted with other information like you've just provided. What you said is absolutely true. We actually have the best economy of all the industrial countries. And the reason we have a good economy is because we've had pretty good policies, not in every case. I'm sure the Biden administration wishes they'd handled inflation differently, as if government could really control it. But they wish they had done some other things, made some other choices. That's always true. No presidency is perfect. But the price of bread and the price of gas are important. But so are the factors you just mentioned. And we have 6 months to go. You know, a lot can change in 6 months.
Right. That's right. A lot can change. And, you know, it's an eternity in politics, right? We worry. We always worry about it. But yeah, I think that bodes well for Democrats, because it doesn't seem that Donald Trump and the Republican Party really have gotten beyond playing to his base and trying to reach. We're always going for those people in the middle. Are we not? You know, we assume, again, they teach us in politics that Democrats vote for Democrats, Republicans vote for Republicans, and the people that you're trying to get are those people in the middle that either switch, you know, during elections or are independent or somewhere else, not either solidly attached to either party. So, I hope that we can make that argument to those people in the middle. And I think that the more Trump is out there and the more he talks, the worse he's going to be. What do you think about the trial starting tomorrow? I think that the Democrats have pushed that too hard. Do you agree? I think that most people don't give a damn that he paid off his girlfriend.
Yeah, this is the least impressive trial of the four. Now, remember, we don't have the other ones because Trump and his lawyers, he's got a law firm full of lawyers proving once again there are two systems of justice in the United States. If you're rich and famous, you can do pretty much anything and at least delay your trials and maybe get off from the charges. And if you are poor or middle class, forget about it. You've got to deal with whatever you get. But I'll say this. There may, in the end, be more to this first trial than we know. The prosecutors may have more hidden than we know about right now. However, if I had my druthers, if somehow I could magically order the trials so that they would have the maximum impact, the first trial would be about January 6th, and the second one would be about classified documents. Because those are very serious matters, and particularly January 6th. So, is it ideal? No. But we need to remember, this has never happened before. You've never had a former president on trial for criminal matters, much less with, now it's 87 felony counts. It was 91. 87 felony counts in four separate jurisdictions. My God. You know, this is what one of our great parties is reduced to. So it bothers me that people are focusing too much on whether they're impressed by the charges in one particular trial. They are looking at one tree that may be in bad shape. They need to look at the forest, which suggests that this particular nominee, that is Donald Trump, is one of the worst trees in the forest. And the forest is healthier than that.
Well, I have to ask you, I can't let you go without asking a few questions about this. And I am proud of the fact that I wrote an article for the Virginia University Policy Review a few years ago about DC statehood. and the need. It was in the fall and winter edition in 2012. Oh, my God, it was a long time ago, about D.C. statehood. What do you think? You think we got any chance for it? It's all about two more senators in the United States Senate with a vote. I know, but think there's any chance with that, that with all the stuff that's going on in America about voter suppression and other things, we're not going to get 60 votes in the Senate. We passed it in the House twice, but you think there's any road that any path for us forward?
Well, obviously, and you know this so much better than I do, it's a tough road to do that. I want you to know, though, and I know you knew this, that I endorsed this a long time ago, and look what impact that had. It has just really moved things along, hasn't it?
You and me both.
I published a book in 2007 that I'm very proud of. It's actually my favorite book, even though it didn't sell as well as, you know, the book on Kennedy, for example. But the book is called A More Perfect Constitution, and I propose 23 changes to the Constitution because our system, our lives, our world have changed so much since the Constitutional Convention and the first Constitution was ratified. And I'm very proud of those changes. They included a complete change in the Electoral College. They included a change in the Senate, adding senators to the more populous states, and yes, giving two senators to the District of Columbia. I also want Puerto Rico to get senators. There may be others. Too. But, you know, it's one thing for an academic to say it, and we know the impact that will have, no matter who the academic is. It's another thing for average Americans to understand that this is actually one way we can make our very unfair Senate more fair.
Yeah, I agree.
Someday it may happen. I'm not going to rule it out. Someday it may happen. It's not going to be in my lifetime. It's just not. But I have faith that over time, this country will respond to reasonable, well-argued proposals for reform, because that's been our history.
Well, and let me just give you a tip here, Doc. If the book wasn't selling, well, do what my professors at the University of Maryland used to do: make your students buy it. We always had to buy their books.
I'm not innocent. I've done the same thing, but you know what they do now? One of them buys it, and then they all photocopy it or put it on the internet, and that's the end of
it.
Yeah. Look, I don't
well, leave it to students. If they can figure out a way to make it work for them. Yeah. Well, I hope that now that I intend to retire next year, I've been elected three consecutive times, but I'm not going to run for re-election. Maybe I can come to UVA and take a course from you. I'd love to buy a few of your books and listen to you lecture. But before I let you go, we're starting to run out of time here. I got to ask you about the crystal ball. How is it that you were able to predict 49 of 50 states in 2020? And do you have any predictions for 2024 that go beyond the presidential election?
We have preliminary predictions, but I stress to everybody, just like polls are inaccurate in April trying to predict a November election, so are judgments like my team makes based on a wide variety of things, not just polling, but demographics and the effects of issues on specific constituencies from state to state. People who make flat predictions this early are basically betting they have a 50-50 chance of being right, because only the Democrat or the Republican is going to win the presidency. So you got a 50-50 chance at a close election. So what if you get it right? It just means you won a 50-50 bet. If only the lottery were that easy, right? We'd all be lottery billionaires. I don't have anything that I want to go public with quite yet. But what we do, we have a great team, and I just love my team. Some of them are professionals. Some of them, believe it or not, quite a few, are students, and they train with us for 4 or 5 years. And they come up with better things than I do. You know, my brain's rusty, or probably got rusty years ago. But they are a big part of this. And every single day we make progress on this, every single day. And that's what you have to do. You don't just drop into an election in middle October and then say, well, let me predict the whole thing for you. You have to work with this as you do anything else day to day. You want a new surgeon out of medical school doing your heart operation? Or do you want somebody who's right. who's been training for a long, long time? That's who you want, right?
Well, that's why I've always felt that term limits were kind of a strange thing, you know, because every congressman has a two-year term limit, right? And if you don't like them, you can vote them out. But we don't seem, it's almost like we're saying, help us because we can't help ourselves. And would you say to a doctor after, you know, Virginia has one of the strangest laws, I think, in America, because I worked with Mark Warner and I worked with Terry McAuliffe. We all worked together at the DNC, and they have a governor for one term. It doesn't, you know, that just seems crazy to me. But
can I make one counter argument to you?
Yeah,
because basically you're right. And the ones you mentioned would have been fine with a second term. You know, Mark Warner, Kane, Terry McAuliffe, they're friends of mine. They did a good job as governor. And I would make exceptions for them. I'd make exceptions for Doug Wyler and others. But the line I use, and people chuckle about it, then they think about it and they could agree with me. The longer I've been around and the more governors of Virginia I've known, the more grateful I've been for the one-term limit. Because you've got to think of the bad ones.
Yeah, there have been bad ones. Yeah, well, I'm from New Jersey, so don't get me started. That's where I grew up, you know. We used to say it was so corrupt that after you became the governor, your next job was building inspector, so that you could make some money.
Cleaning the canteen in the jail.
Yeah, I bet. But let me ask you, since we're getting ready to end here, you've been kind enough to stay with us for more than 50 minutes. So let me ask you, is there something that you want to say that I haven't asked you that you think is important to say, Doctor, before you leave the show?
Yes. This is the most important communication I can make in an election year, particularly to an audience like yours. You may not be thrilled with the candidates. You may not be thrilled with the way the issues are moving, but every election is important, and this one is very, very important. Motivation wins elections. Now, right now, I would have to say that the Trump base and Republicans generally are more motivated than the Biden base and Democrats are. If that continues all the way into the fall, then you can just start saying President Trump again. Or your alternative is to explain why it's important to your kids, to your other relatives, to your friends, to your neighbors on your street, to the people at your church. Get them involved and active in understanding why every election is critical, and this one is more critical than most.
Well, from your lips to God's ear, Dr. Sabato, thank you so much for being on the show. We're going to have you back if you're willing to come closer to the election so you can give us some of those predictions and we can keep an eye on you and make sure your batting average is still one of the most amazing in politics. Thank you so much for being on the show. We play every show out with a song that we dedicate to the person that's been on the show. And this, sir, is my favorite campaign song, since you're so good at picking campaigns. This is my favorite campaign song of all time. It was actually written by the candidate. So here's Every Man a King, that was written by Huey Long.
I love that.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much for being on the show. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it and how fondly I remember you from 42 years ago. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. And let me congratulate you on your extensive career and the terms that you have served all this time trying to do good things. And we salute you. Hope that more people come in and try to be like you.
Okay, well, I'm going to register for a course. You watch me. I'm going to be the old guy in the back raising my hand all the time.
Students just hate it when seniors register for my class.
I know. We do the recommended reading. It pisses them off. All right. I'll see you, Doc. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Right.
See you next week, folks.
Why weep or slumber, America, land of brave and true? There's castles and clothing and food for all. All belongs to you. Every man a king, every man a king.
Representation in the capital of this nation. Give the people their right to vote.